Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
Tonight we're studying 3 John. Should be able to complete this series that we've had on 1st, 2nd, 3rd John tonight. And in this little short book, we are introduced to 3 people, 2 of whom are quite commendable. One whom we've heard spoken of many times, and he is certainly not a commendable person. The passage begins, "The elder unto the well-beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth." Unlike the other 2 books, the 1st and 2nd John, this one was written to an individual. Now, the same one that wrote 2nd John obviously wrote 3rd John, the elder, which, and we won't go through a great review of determining how that was probably the Apostle John, but we will just take it tonight. We understand this was John writing to a man named Gaius. Gaius was not an unusual Bible name, really. At least a name in that time. Sort of like the name John or James or Bill or names like that. Rather common names. We read of a Gaius in the church in Corinth. Ephesus. The Apostle Paul converted a man there named Gaius. I don't know whether it's the same Gaius or not. But his character and his behavior seems to suggest that it could have been. But that's not really important. Regardless of who this person is, the thoughts that are written here in this inspired scripture are applicable to me and to you. Now that's the important thing for us to always keep in mind when we read scripture. And you'll notice that there was a strong, affectionate feeling one toward the other, and obviously the tie that bound them together, they both loved the truth. It's just be very difficult not to have a great respect and love for another person who loved the truth if you love the truth. You may not even particularly like their looks. You may not be too keen on their personality. But if they show in this and display a love for the truth, that's what counts in an individual. And you would have no difficulty at all in looking upon them as being well beloved. Again, he uses the term beloved. "I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth." The writer was concerned not only for the spiritual welfare of this person, but the physical as well. Brethren, should not we be glad when those around us who are righteous individuals succeed, when they prosper, when they have good health? We may not have good health, but we're thankful they do. We may not materially prosper, but we ought to be glad that they do. Here's a man that evidently was getting the very best of life from all points. He had his health, he had material sufficiency, yea, prosperity, and he had spiritual prosperity. Now, what more can a man ask? What else is there in life that would even surpass that or even equal that? He had what mattered in this existence, and so the writer, he said, "I hope, I wish, I pray that this might be the case with you." You know, we stress a lot of times, particularly and properly, when people suffer and they suffer loss or death strikes in their family, we weep with those that weep. Well, when someone succeeds spiritually, financially, materially, whatever, why, we ought to also be able to rejoice with them that rejoice. We ought never be envious or never be jealous. Be glad for the good that comes to another. And verse 3, For I rejoiced greatly when the brethren came and testified of the truth that is in thee, even as thou walkest in the truth. Now, I don't know who it was that told him of how Gaius was walking so steadfastly in the truth, but whoever it was, it certainly brought delight and joy to his heart, to the writer's heart, did it not? Verse 4, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Now, to the writer here, John, the children, no doubt, to whom he referred were his brethren. Probably people who were brethren because he had been an instrument in converting them. Therefore, he would speak of them as his children. But I want you to take another look at this word children here in terms of my children or your children. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. Now, I mentioned up there a few moments ago in verse 2, here's a man who has health. Here's a man who has material prosperity. Here's a man who spiritually prospereth. All that's well and good. And I said, what more could a person ever have in life than such things as verse 2 mentions? Well, if there is anything, it would be what verse 4 mentions, wouldn't it? Now, many of you have children. I want to be cautious what I say here. I don't want to conjure up thoughts of regret or sadness in any disappointments any of us have ever had concerning our children. That's not the point. We need to encourage our young people. They must start early if their children are going to walk in truth. I one time had an elder of the church, Brother Charles Hodden. He was teaching a class on leadership in the church, and someone asked him, said, when is a good time to start training a man to be an elder of the church? He said, start with his grandmother. You just can't start too soon. And you just can't start too soon in bringing your child up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And one of the greatest, if not the greatest satisfaction of life is when they reach an age of responsibility and accountability, and they stand on their own feet, and I'm not always just exactly sure when that is. I heard talking with some parents the other day, where I think we shared in common, we're working ourselves to death trying to keep our children independent. But just the same, I don't know exactly when the time comes when they are no longer leaning on you. You always sort of want them to a little bit, don't you? And still at the same time, you don't want them to think that they have to. But the greatest satisfaction in the world is hear your children and they are walking in the truth. That, to me, is a blessing that just surpasses blessings. You'd rather have that than health. You'd rather have that than material prosperity. I'd rather have that than my own personal spiritual prosperity. Know that my children walk in truth. Beloved, thou doest faithfully whatsoever thou doest to the brethren and to strangers. Now here's some additional compliments, commendations to this man. You're faithful, you're working hard, you keep on keeping on, and not only with the brethren, here come some with whom you're not particularly associated and acquainted, you're doing good work. And what about these people which have borne witness of thy charity before the church? Other people recognize the work that you are doing. Whom, if thou bringest forward on their journey after a godly sort, thou shalt do well. The implication is here were people that came into the association of Gaius who were in need of assistance. They were going from one place to another. They came to where he was. Gaius expended himself in some way to help them in their task, to help them in their work. And notice he said, verse 7, because that for his name's sake they went forth, taking nothing of the Gentiles. They were going out here working for the name of the Lord. And they weren't going out expecting to be supported by those to whom they were going, which would have been all right. Paul did both. Paul was supported by others as he went to places, and at times he took of those also who to whom he preached and commended that. But Gaius was the person that when someone came and he was involved in the work of the Lord and he needed assistance, why, he tried to help him. But notice this next verse, and here's a great principle. We therefore ought to receive such, that we might be fellow helpers to the truth. Now, these people that were coming through during the work of the Lord, we ought to receive them. We ought to accept them. We ought to encourage them. Brethren that come into our midst from time to time, they come from what we call mission fields. Every field is a mission field, rightly thought of, but distant places. And they come into our midst. We ought to do everything that we can to receive them, to show that they are acceptable, that we want to be of help, because in doing so, and when we help them, in doing so, we're doing more than helping them, aren't we? We're helping what they are doing. We're not just giving them a personal favor. We're helping the truth. Now, just as surely as when we help those of the truth, we are helping truth when we lend assistance or appearance of condoning those who are not of the truth, we are also being opposed to the truth. If you help a man of truth, then you're helping truth. Then if you lend assistance and encouragement to a man of error, why aren't you encouraging error? Brother Foy Wallace used to say, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. It looks like that's a two-edged sword. That cuts both ways, doesn't it? And this gets us back to what the writer had said back over there in 2 John 9 through 11. You just cannot scripturally, properly lend assistance to anything and just anybody. You cannot give Godspeed to those who are not faithful in the doctrine of Christ. Why? Why, if you do, you're lending assistance and encouragement to error. God's going to hold people responsible for what they do and for what they encourage. There's not a one of us in here that doesn't have influence, varying degrees of influence, but everybody's got influence, and that's another matter that's certainly going to be taken into consideration when we stand before God in judgment. Not only what we say, not only what we think, not only what we do, but the direction in which our eyes were pushing, the things that we were upholding and the things that we were resisting. We'll be held accountable and responsible for that also. Now, this was Gaius, and he was a good man. Anyone have any comments that you want to make about Gaius or any of the points that you see that we haven't touched upon here in the first 8 verses before we're introduced to another man? Yes. Yeah, that's what I tried to suggest as I went through. It could well have been the same man because the characteristics of the man seem to be so commendable every time you read about him. He was a companion. He was a helper. All right, any other comment, anybody? Okay, now let's look at another fella that we are not so impressed with him. I wrote unto the church. Now, I don't know what church this is, but it doesn't make any difference. It could have been East End. Except he mentions a specific man, which meant it was a specific congregation. But Diotrephes. Now, what about this man? Who loveth to have the preeminence among them, receiveth us not. Now, first let me remind you how that Gaius had been commended because he received brethren, accepted brethren, helped brethren, and in so doing helped the truth. But now here's Diotrephes. He was not so ready to receive even the writer, was he? He wouldn't even receive us, he said. What was wrong with Diotrephes? Big I, little you. I like to speak of it this way. He had to be big dog in the kennel. He had to be Mr. Prominent. If he wasn't top man on the totem pole, he was going to keep working until he got there. He had an attitude, evidently, I'll be boss. You ever run into people that act like they're the boss? Well, sure, if you work with people, you've probably got a boss, unless you are the boss. And in a lot of affairs of life, there has to be a boss, doesn't it? In any affair of life, there has to be a leader. In the army, you've got to have a leader and a boss and anything else that you might need to enforce what has to be done. But those who lead in the Lord's church, they're not to have a boss attitude. That would be what the Apostle Peter would call lording it over the flock. Now, I don't know that nothing here suggests necessarily that Diotrephes was an elder. We don't know that. He just may have been a person in the congregation who just always insisted, we're going to have things my way. No, if he was an elder, he was out of step, wasn't he? But he didn't have to be. You can be out of step without being an elder. It's maybe be easier to get out of step if you're an elder. It sure is. It's easier. You got more responsibility on you. But this attitude that he had, now, he's got to have the preeminence. Now, everybody's got to know who I am and what I think, and everything's got to go my way. It could have been Brother Pulpit Man, couldn't it? You ever seen anybody in the pulpit that felt like he had to have everything his way? Now look at the wall when you answer. Don't you look this way. Because you're not teaching. All right. Now. Okay. Yes, he could have been the man trying to run things from a position where he had no authority, but would just try to. That always causes trouble. That'll always create problems, create friction. Somebody out of step. And what is it that possesses the individual to be so insecure as to feel like he's got to be top over anybody else? So many times, the person who has to blow his horn so loudly is the person that can't find anybody else to even blow it a little bit for him. He's insecure. He's not that confident about himself. He wants to make sure he's recognized. What was it you were hearing something today? You told me something today about a person that gets power and then they soon confuse it as wisdom. We had a lesson on how to be a husband there today, I think. You told me about this. You read that from Reader's Digest. You read that heavy material. That so many times people who get power, now they were talking about business. Politics, yeah, they were talking about politics. And sometimes people get power and they begin to confuse their power as being wisdom. They're not necessarily the same thing at all. You read the article too, didn't you? That's not necessarily the same thing at all. So many times, power is in the hands of those who manifest the least amount of wisdom, it looks like. And here Diotrephes, evidently he had some power. He was able to throw his weight around. So much so that it was a problem. But notice what the writer says about him. Wherefore, if I come, I will remember his deeds which he doeth, prating against us with malicious words. And not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and forbiddeth them that would, and casteth them out of the church. Not only would he not receive these noble brethren that would come into their midst on the journey after a godly sort, he didn't want you to help him either. And if you did, he'd not only throw the workers out, he'd try to throw you out too. Now, he was a bad one to deal with, wasn't he? And John says now, when I get there, I'll deal with him. When I get there, I'll handle him. He was one who was capable and obviously exercising ability of great influence and power among brethren, but he was also guilty of using malicious words, hateful words, misrepresentations, falsifications, things to hurt and to harm and to damage. And he would be the kind of person who just had to dictate. He had to be the quarterback. He had to call the play. You know, the more I talk about this, the more I think this sounds like some preachers that I've met and some elders that I've known. No, evidently not. Everybody was supposed to bow to him. Preeminent. Now he says in verse 11, "Beloved, follow not that which is evil, but that which is good. He that doeth good is of God, but he that doeth evil hath not seen God." Now, if that isn't an indictment against Diotrephes, don't you follow people whose interest is a self-interest. Self-promoters. They're not up for good. They're not doing good. They don't have the interest of the Lord's church at heart or the brethren. Self is in their focus. This is what they want. This is what they strive for. And so they call the shots. They dictate what is to be done. They make the decision. If you don't agree with them, out you go. Now, I don't know what was the nature of the things where he was being so bombastically dictatorial. Whether it was over matters of opinion or whether it was over matters of doctrine. Now, let's assume for a moment. Now, this is not in here now. We're assuming now for a moment. And then you give the solution to it. Let's assume that the church here was going off in a tangent. It was doctrinally wrong. And he was bossing things around to keep it right. Does that change your attitude about Diotrephes? Right, you don't have to stand for the truth with malicious words, do you? He'd been still wrong there. What about that though? What if he'd been standing up for right and the church was going wrong? That isn't what he heard about, that's for sure. No, what he had heard about him is he wants to be preeminent. And if it had been a matter of doctrine, he might have mentioned it. Well, what if it had been a matter of opinion? A matter of opinion. Let's think of a matter of opinion. Somebody think of a matter of opinion that sometimes creates trouble in the church. Somebody. I can think of a number of them, but I'll let you come up with one that you cause trouble. I mean, one that you've heard about. Color of the carpet. You know that's the truth. You know brethren have gotten almost down to fisticuffs. Sisters down to fisticuffs because the brethren were just paying for it and the sisters were going to decide what color it was. Oh boy, that was a mistake. But anyway, over the color of the carpet. You ever have anybody, ever heard of anybody or seen anybody among God's people who would absolutely get uptight and have to direct and boss color schemes? I always have to grin and smile a little bit when I think of color schemes. And my mother, it has nothing to do with this at all, but when she talks about putting on a new cover on the sofa, And you've got a certain color rug, and you've got a certain color drape, and you've got to get the covering for the look. And she's always talking about this will pick up that, and this color will pick up that. And Mama's always picking up this color, and picking up that color. And some of you know what, I guess, what she's talking about. Well, it's nice to have a nice facility, and we got a nice one, but I'd sure hate to think we'd ever have a falling out over whether it's going to be this old dirty faded needs to be replaced gold, or whether it's or whether it's going to be some nice pretty color. I don't know. But who would ever say a word about it? I'm ashamed of anybody to even say anything about things like that, aren't you? Why, you wouldn't want to get upset over that. A matter of opinion, now those are the kind of things that Diotrephes may have been trying to boss his way around. Whatever it was, he was doing what he was doing in an ugly way and in a bossy way. Well, enough of Diotrephes. We need Gaius. There's no room for a Diotrephes. But here's Demetrius. He turned back to the positive and good side. Demetrius hath good report of all men. Can you imagine that? And of the truth itself. Yea, and we also bear record, and ye know that our record is true. All the brethren looked, and obviously they were faithful brethren. All the brethren looked upon Demetrius as a man of truth. He obviously went about his work in the right sort of way. John knew him personally. John also could bear record. John says, you know that I know. John joined in this good report about Demetrius. What a difference in men between Diotrephes and Demetrius. Demetrius is the kind of person that we ought to strive to be. Now, in Acts the 19th chapter, we read about a Demetrius over there. And it's very likely that it is certainly not the same Demetrius, because this Demetrius, unless there was a tremendous change, was the man who was the silversmith who instigated a riot against Paul and the other Christians because they were making little images and idols of Diana, the goddess, and Paul, preaching against idolatry, had cut into their business. But this obviously is not the same Demetrius, unless, and it could be, the last Demetrius later on was converted and turned his aggressive attentions to truth just as much as he had one time toward error. There's a possibility that that is true. Demetrius and Gaius are names of men, both of whom were in the same city. Could have been the same Gaius, could have been the same Demetrius, could have been different, didn't make any difference. Now, verse 13. I have many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write unto thee, but I trust I shall shortly see thee, and we shall speak face to face. Peace be to thee. Our friends salute thee. Greet the friends by name. Notice the somewhat exceptional personal concern and personal touch with which he concludes this writing. He anticipated visiting with them. There are other things that obviously could be said, need to be said. He was going to wait till he got there on the scene and to deliver the other information that was needed. A little short book, but it sure gives us very brief but interesting biographical sketches, doesn't it, of three people and quite a contrast in those people. Let's just raise a question. Are there matters that can be handled better face-to-face in lieu of correspondence? Are there matters that could be handled better by correspondence rather than face-to-face? Might be the only way they can even be reached. Distance, hostility, closed door and closed mind, there may not be any other way. True, when you write it down, or when it's written to you, there it is. Now, let me raise this point. do we always, in a letter, maybe convey just precisely everything that we'd really like to convey? I've never been able to do it. I've tried. I've written letters sometimes. The way I like to write a letter where my feathers are ruffled a little bit, I get the letter, and I'm teed off. None of you ever get that way, but you see, you've never been a preacher. Somebody has. And you're just a little bit warm around the car. And so you go and you write it off, brother. You get it out of your system. I do. I really write it off. Now that'll get him fixed. And fortunately, most of the time, I've had sense enough to put it up. Let it sit there a while. Let the temperature cool. And then go back 2 or 3 days and read that thing again. And say, well, that's not really what I wanted to say. That's not going to go over 2 years. So I lowered about 10 degrees. Put it aside. Depends on what the case is, how many days you have to let temperature go down. And pretty soon you get it down to some degree of moderation. And I have found the first draft will take about 3 pages or more. And finally, when you get all the steam and all the heat and all the bombastic baloney out of it, a couple of paragraphs probably be enough. Any of you ever feel that way? Ever write that way? Maybe you don't write like some of us correspond back and forth. But I'll tell you, you write a book, or you put out a paper, or you hold meetings, you're going to get letters from people you don't even remember seeing, and from people you probably won't ever see again, and from some people you hope you don't. And that's the only way you can deal with it. And really, it's sometimes very hard to put down on paper what you can just sit down and talk. If the people are of a disposition, and it's geographically possible, of a disposition to be companionable, or at least, what's the word I want? Congenial, that's as good as I can find a bad one. Get along, whether it be civil, one toward another. There are few situations that you can't sit down and just work it out. I mean, good situations where both of you are seeing things alike, you want to get something done, or whether both of you you sort of cross paths a little bit. You can just sit there and cause you can explain what you mean and then explain again what you mean and then explain your explanation and just keep on going until you get it all worked out. That's good. And then we'll forget. It's funny now. And I didn't even know. I went to see this fella. I've known him for years. Went to see him one time. I was in an area holding a meeting. And I walked in on him. And if something just told me something's not right here, what is it? Well, the first pop out of the box, he began to apologize to me like everything. I said, well, I'll accept your apology, now tell me for what. I didn't know what had happened. Well, he found out I'd moved to Mac Menville. I wasn't, he said, working under elders. I'd never been in a church, didn't have elders in my life. And therefore, I was doing things and saying things and preaching in a way that I wouldn't dare do if I had elders. I said, called him my name. I said, man, I've always worked under elders. Where'd you get that information? Well, come to find out, they say, you know, huh? Malicious words, yeah. He's taking up for me. But he said, I want you to know I'm sorry. I found out that that's not true. And I said, well, I sure am glad for your attitude, but I said, buddy, you never told me about it. I'd never known about it and wouldn't care. We left there the best of friends you ever saw. He's moved to another church now. I'm going to hold a meeting there in a couple of years. At his instigation, he got me to come hold that meeting. Now, boy, that eyeball conversation is worth money on the pocket. Not just mean money. I'm talking about that's just friendship. We're close as peas in a pod now. Eyeball, eyeball. Best conversation in the world. Well, Next week, Lord willing, next class, we're going to begin a study of the book of Luke. Let me encourage you to familiarize yourself with at least the first chapter or so. It has to do with the life of Christ. We'll be talking about the various things there, the way and the manner of our Lord, those around Him, what He said, the application to ourselves. We'll start with the book of Luke next week. Any further comments? They are everywhere. They say. And if you ever find out who they are, you'll know where most things come from.